Low Profile from Ruinous Media.
Hello, this is Laura Logic from X-Ray Specs and Essential Logic, and you're listening to KAOS Olympia.
Hey, what's good? It's Low Profile. I'm Mark Lee Morrison.
And I'm Dylan Shearer.
Dylan's co-hosting the show today, and we are interviewing Laura Logic.
Who is Laura Logic?
Founding member of X-Ray Specs and Essential Logic, and also has an album just under her own name.
Mm-hmm.
Huge fan of hers, absolutely. And yeah, she's going to introduce herself, tell you a little bit about herself right here.
Well, Laura Logic is, she's the actress that I play in this given incarnation, and one that's very well suited actually to my psychological nature, because I'm artistic by nature, and I wasn't really allowed to express that when I was growing up at home. I was very much pushed down academic channels, so I rebelled against that. Susan Whitby, and I thought up the name Laura Logic in the car on the way to the first X-Ray Specs gig, and after that, that was the persona that I felt very comfortable with. Although a lot of people would say I'm not really that logical, I'm probably a little bit too emotional. I live in Hertfordshire, about 20 miles from London, and this has been my home on and off in between extended visits to India. This has been my home since the early 80s.
Excellent.
Yeah, my kids are grown up now, and I like it here because it's really near the Krishna community and the Krishna temple, the estate which George Harrison of the Beatles gave to the very early Krishna followers. Must have been in the 70s, yeah. And I live near there, so it's nice. They have cows and a lake, and you know, it's a good place to go and escape. So I'm happy to be located here. It's also near London, so I've got the best of both worlds, really. Hmm.
So I'm just gathering that perhaps Hare Krishna is a big part of your life.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like to talk about Krishna, you know, I can't help myself.
Mm-hmm. When did it start to bleed into your music?
Well, I think really since the very early days, because I was actually making a film called Crystal Gazing. Mm-hmm. While Essential Logic was still on Rough Trade, and the location was just there in Portobello Road in Notting Hill Gate area. And that's when I first saw the Hare Krishna devotees on the streets, dressed in sort of traditional Indian clothing and jumping up and down and looking exceedingly happy, playing musical instruments and singing Hare Krishna. So that was the first time, apart from when I was five and I went to central London with my mum, and I thought they were gypsies. I saw these strange people who I only twigged later they were actually Hare Krishnas. And I was fascinated by them and the mantra they were singing, I was very little, and I went up to look close, and my mum grabbed my hand and pulled me away really, really sharply. So maybe that was a bit of a premonition she was having, because she really didn't like me moving into the temple and all that. Anyway, so yeah, I was in Portobello Road and I saw them, and then I realised I saw that my best friend from school was in amongst them, and she'd been a hardcore punk and, you know, she'd been into self-harming and an amphetamine user, and I saw this change in her, and I was actually quite worried about her because I thought she's been swallowed up by some cult.
Right, right. Krishna's, it's a little maybe the antithesis of the punk ethos.
In some ways, yeah, in some ways.
On the surface, I would say, it appears to be that way. Like, that's the last place you would expect to see your friend.
Yeah, although she was always an extremist. And whatever she did was extreme. So on one level, she was like all or nothing. So on one level, I could, you know, I actually respected her because she'd found a philosophy and she was living it. But there's a lot of similarities, you know, oh, bondage up yours. I mean, that's about rejecting all different forms of bondage, and the ultimate statement of the Bhagavad Gita, the Krishna teachings, is that we're all in extreme bondage. We're here in this material world and full of so many temporary restrictions, so the whole idea is to break out of that. So there are similarities.
I first became aware of you and your music through X-Ray Specs, who you've mentioned. You were a founding member of the group, weaving melodies throughout the song that don't interfere with the lyrics. Why the saxophone? How did you come to bring your passion for playing the saxophone into this this burgeoning punk movement that was happening?
It was all quite surreal, and it all happened so spontaneously and quickly at the time. I was only 15. Mm-hmm. I'd been playing for about 3 years the saxophone. It was my father's favorite instrument, and he surprised me one day with a saxophone, because I'd lost interest in every other classical instrument that had been put in front of me. And he just listened to jazz all day long, Stan Getz. He wasn't very well, and it soothed him, the sound of the saxophone. And in the hope that I'd take it up, he actually bought me one. I was very surprised. I kind of fell in love with it when I first saw it. I didn't like his taste in music, but I worship David Bowie, and David Bowie played the saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And Roxy Music, I loved Roxy Music. And I just thought to look in Melody Maker and to join a band. And X-Ray Specs, that was pretty much the first advert I answered. It was, yeah.
Yeah.
And the manager picked up the phone and said, we're not really, he said young punks wanted. And he said, we're not really looking for a girl, and we're not looking for a saxophonist.
Wow.
I think we're not looking for it. But he was, you know, quite ruthless in his ambitions for the band. So he said, but come along anyway. So I did. I went to the audition. They didn't even want to hear me play the saxophone. He just saw me and he thought, two young girls together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a punk band, one can play the sax, and you really didn't have to have any particular qualifications to get up on the stage at the Roxy.
How old were the others in the group? Were you the baby?
Yeah. I was the baby. Holly was 2.5, 3 years older than me. Hmm. Maybe 3 years older than me. And then Paul Dean was the next youngest, the bass player. Mm-hmm. Jack, they were all about similar ages. The first drummer we had was called Rich T, and he in fact used to play with Queen before they made it.
Oh wow.
And he wasn't punk at all. I don't know how he even came to the first audition, because they were auditioning drummers. But he did, and he played that first gig with us at the Roxy. But he was kicked out because his hair was too long and he refused to cut it.
Oh, that's a crime.
He had this lovely, long, curly hair.
One thing I can't wrap my head around, and I guess, you know, it was a different time, but what are a bunch of teenagers who haven't played a gig yet doing with a manager already?
It was a peculiar setup, to be honest. It was very peculiar, which I didn't question too much at the time, because I was very naive and very young. I had no experience of bands or music business, anything like that. But it was quite peculiar. Yeah, there was this... So Falcon Stewart, who was the manager of the band, he had met Polly about 3 years earlier. He sort of modelled himself on Malcolm McLaren. He wanted to be some kind of Spengali manager figure. And when he met Polly, he just thought, well, you know, this girl's got charisma, she's got talent, I'm going to get her into the limelight one way or another. This is way before X-ray specs. Mm. And, I mean, she told me a lot of these things at the very beginning when I, you know, before any of the funny stuff settled in and before her bipolar kicked in. They were living together for about 3 years before X-ray Specs was formed. But he was shady character, as I think most people will testify, especially the band members.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, just having a teenage girl move in with you when you're managing, that seems like a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, she was like 17 and he must have been about 35. He was no good. I mean, I could tell you a lot of other things about him, but I'm not going to.
Yeah. That's not what we're here to do, I guess.
No.
So this is a really pivotal time in your storied music career, but for you, it's such a brief window of your youth, and they replaced you out of the blue. And you came to do your own thing that was just so unique and different from anything happening in the musical landscape, if you ask me. Just the jump from X-ray Specs into Essential Logic. Just really like to know more about the evolution there.
Yeah, it was totally unplanned. After I realized I wasn't in X-ray Specs anymore, which I only found out, I mean, I wasn't told I wasn't in X-ray Specs, but after I found out I wasn't and I had been replaced, I was shocked. I was depressed. I put my saxophone away and I decided I didn't want anything more to do with this sordid music business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still at school, so I just kind of finished the term, and then I had to do something next. So the only thing I was interested at school was art, and my portfolio was good enough to get me into art school. So the autumn term after leaving X-ray Specs, I went to art school. I was hoping to study photography, but I wasn't there long before I was tracked down by a chap called Jeff Mann, whose father owned an independent record company, one of the very first ones called Sells Records. And he said, he used to wait for me outside art school at lunchtimes. He said, why don't you record a record? You were the best thing about X-ray Specs. Why don't you do something? And I just brushed it off. I just thought, I'm not a songwriter. I can't sing. where would I start? And I still had such a sour taste in my mouth. But he kept pursuing it and meeting me. So then I thought, okay, I wasn't liking art school very much anyway. It was a bit of a ghost town. I was supposed to have a tutor who was never there. He was having a nervous breakdown. All the students were just, it was in Soho, were down the pub snorting cocaine. And I just thought I wasn't really going to get very far in the art school. So I went home and somehow or another, I don't know why, but in half an hour, I just wrote this song called Aerosol Burns. How my voice might sound, or I didn't go through any filters at all. And then I just thought, well, who can help me? Who can play on this with me? And I contacted Stuart Action, who was a big fan of X-Ray Specs. I found his details in a fanzine or something. And then he had a friend called Tim Wright who played bass, and I got hold of Rich T, who'd also been kicked out of X-Ray Specs. So I thought, oh, we've got something in common. And then I think I sent them a cassette. I sang the song with the sax lines onto a cassette. They worked out the chords, and we just turned up in this sort of posh recording studio in St. John's Wood, and just we hammered out Aerosol Burns and then an instrumental called World Friction. And that was it. And then Jeff Mann from Sells Records, he thought it was amazing, so he said, well, I'm going to take this to Rough Trade Records to see if we can get a proper distribution for it. And Jeff Travis heard it, sort of the artistic heyday, and he said, oh, I love this. And I met Jeff, and then he said, okay, when's the album and where's your band? That's it. And it was like coming to Rough Trade. It was so different from the experience I'd had in X-Ray Specs. It was like a family. You could go there and you could eat with them at lunchtimes, and they cared about you, and they asked about your life, and was everything going okay, and were you happy, and was anything they could help you out with. And it was just such a different experience. I really loved those years with Rough Trade.
Yeah,
it sounds like a solid community, and there's a lot of overlap with the musicians in that era. You know, we spoke with Mayo Thompson just a couple weeks ago. He said that both of you guys collaborated with each other's projects. Is there anything you can remember that stands out from working with the Red Crayola and the Kangaroo record?
Have you heard Soldier Talk as well? The first album.
Oh yeah.
So I take it you're both big Red Crayola fans.
Yeah,
yeah. You could definitely say that.
In my experience, Red Crayola don't appeal to everybody.
True.
Mm-hmm. And so I find it. Yeah, I'm just trying to find out what your level of enthusiasm. Is or was
quite enthusiastic.
Well, I guess those times were just so varied and eclectic and creative that there were no barriers really at that time. No genres, apart from there was like the alternative and then there was the mainstream, but there wasn't so much in between, I don't think, kind of late 70s and early 80s.
Just a very experimental period, anything goes.
It was really, looking back, it was so unique. There was so much opportunity for individuals.
Like, did you perform with them as well, or was it just a recording, a studio endeavor?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, my fondest memories, I think we did a tour of Great Britain. We did two tours of Europe with Red Crayola and Gina Birch. She was there for one tour, which was great fun. I've always loved playing with Gina in different contexts. Particularly European audiences were so receptive. Probably less traditional in their tastes as well. So the music that Red Crayola was making was, more on their wavelength.
Hi, I'm Anna Winter. Do you love listening to Low Profile? It always helps if you tell a friend about your favorite episodes. You can sign up for flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/lowprofile. Now, let's get to today's show.
Yeah, so really, really enjoyed touring with Red Crayola. And then I think Scritti Politti was on the bill as well for some of those European
They were
tours.
Something else.
Oh, they were, yeah. I mean, especially the first incarnation of Scritti Politti was just awesome. I remember we used to go around because we lived in squats and Essential Logic. Some of us lived in squats for a few years. Do you know what a squat is?
Well, I do, and I think Dylan does, but let's enlighten the listener.
Well, I don't know, because we don't have them anymore these days. But they were just houses which were generally owned by the government, by the councils, by the local authorities, but they were empty. So the law was in those days that if you went into a squat building, and some of them were beautiful, they were old Victorian houses with fireplaces. Then the law was you just changed the lock on the door and nobody could get rid of you. Nobody could ask you to leave.
Wow.
So it was cheap. It was a great way to live. And it was, it was a very funky way to live. Of course, there wasn't always water
or
a good amount of electricity. We used to go and bathe at the local Victorian bathhouses. And I don't even know if they exist anymore, but they were places where you could go, you paid a few pennies, and you could have a bath.
Yeah. Was it largely artsy folks?
Yeah, it was. It was musicians or artsy people. Everyone on our street was like that. Milton Grove in Stoke Newington. I haven't been back there. I don't know what it's like now.
I wanted to go back a little bit because I'm curious about your process of like how you go about writing songs. I mean, just the fact that you were like, I'm going to tackle this thing. It's just I'm curious, like when, like lyrically, like what's the process you usually do?
I think for the last album, which I probably most closely identify with out of all the recordings.
Land of Kali.
Yeah, the Land of Kali. For that, even though I was a mom and sort of switching off the music channel for a couple of decades, I would keep a lyric notebook and like so many other songwriters and write things down. Not too much, because I knew that if I was going to be a mom, and I wasn't so young when I had my first daughter, I had to just focus on that, and because music was always totally consuming for me, literally like flipping a switch, and it would be very difficult for me to do both without feeling resentful or, I feel very unsatisfied like that. So
yeah.
I had some notebooks with ideas, and they were themes that had been on my mind probably for about 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
And especially like the title track, Land of Kali.
In the land of Kali, there is no such thing as lucky. In the hands of Kali, I lost my memory.
Yeah, it was predominantly recorded in lockdown on my own, that album. I had some help in the beginning from a South American musician I'd met called Jorge Morales. And I'd sort of met him by accident, and he'd triggered off the whole recording process. But then lockdown kicked in and I finished the album on my own in contact with Youth Martin on the internet and occasional visits to his house when lockdown permitted secret visits.
So you're just learning as you go with the latest record.
Well, and on the new one, you also incorporate, is it your daughter that is on that?
Yeah, Marlene.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a wonderful way to bond with her. She was at drama school at the time. It was hard to kidnap her because I always wanted to, liaise with her. She's such an artist in her own right, and she has an incredible voice. And she just came into my room one day and said, "Mum, let's write a song together." Mm. So we wrote Skyrocket together. She said, "Well, what should we write about? What do you want to write about?" I said, "What do you want to write about? Because you call the shots. You always call the shots." So she said, "Where's your scrapbook? Where's your lyric scrapbook?" So she pulled out a chorus that I'd written, "Death, it won't happen to me. I live in eternity. So we wrote this song together, and then I just recorded her. I learned as I went along, and a lot of the lyrics are philosophical, the land of Cully, and very much felt in the land of Cully in lockdown. The land of Cully is described as, it's a dark age in the Vedas. We go through four ages, and the worst age is the age of Cully. It's the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. We're governed by leaders who just cheat us and exploit us. And yeah, it's just not a great age to be in. And I think that's pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that tracks.
War, pestilence, strife, you know, we're surrounded by it. The best age is called Satya Yuga. It's the golden age. But we're talking about long, long eras of time here. It's not just ages that last a few years. We're talking about, over millennia, thousands and thousands of years. But it's a cycle. So you've got the Golden Age, you've got the Silver Age, you've got the Bronze Age, and you've got the Iron Age. And the Kali Age is the Iron Age. It's like the basest metal, the lowest. It's symbolized by the lowest metal. And you can read all about it in a book called The Srimad Bhagavatam, which is very fascinating. It talks about everything, really.
The music direction that you've gone after such a long break, I'm wondering how informed it is by things that you and perhaps your daughter have been enjoying.
Yeah, well, to be honest, throughout my life, I mean, I grew up, when I was in Essential Logic and in squats, there was a DJ that lived in the building. So whatever he played was a major influence of me on me. Stuff like Talking Heads, funk, reggae. Mm-hmm. He was African, so, you know, all music African, which I was always very, very drawn to. In fact, I was regressed once, and I was informed that I was an African trumpeter that lived in Detroit in my last life. I'm not necessarily going to go with that one.
Okay.
But it kind of makes sense, you know, because I do very much feel, I've always been attracted by those kinds of music. So in the interim, after living in Temple, so I spent a lot of time living in India as well, coming and going. I homeschooled my kids in India.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of the music I was listening to was from that planet. It was very much kirtan, madanga drums, harmoniums, kartels, you know, those kind of rhythms. When I came back in 2019 and started recording Land of Kali, and I only really got back into all of this again because I guess it was triggered. I met Celeste Bell, who's Polystyrene's daughter, and she'd made that movie.
I Am a Cliche. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it at the local art house theater. It was very thoughtfully put together by Celeste.
Yes.
And there's definitely some, a lot of sadness to that story. But you can't deny all the joy that she brought into the world as well.
Yeah, Polly, she is, and she was a one-off. Mm-hmm. She's very much on my mind actually at the moment as well, because Conscious Consumer is going to be re-released, the second X-Ray Specs album.
Right, right.
That's being released for the first time ever on vinyl on December the 15th.
On that album, on Conscious Consumer, we have an earlier version of Prayer for Peace.
Oh, you noticed.
Oh, I noticed, yeah.
We got something, don't you know that's true? We got something, don't you feel it too? We got something. We got something to do. Not a machine line that I'm pushing on you. Just another blue note, I'm slightly out of tune. We got something.
It is. It's very different. But actually, the very first original version was recorded by Polly and I when we lived in a Krishna community in Worcestershire in the early 1980s.
Okay. Wow.
I arranged and helped to get that together, and I put sax on it.
We got something, don't you know that it's true? We got something, don't you feel it too? A breath of peace, a breath of peace. Japa mala mala, a breath of peace, a breath of peace. Japa mala mala.
Was that the Juggernaut project?
Yeah, well, after we collided again, we were living in this country sort of community, and there was a very small recording studio there. We formed a band called Juggernaut, and we did one gig actually at Glastonbury Festival. We did a couple of outings. We did the Woman of the Year lunch at the Savoy Hotel, which was terribly posh. We did a song each. Polly did a song. I did a song. But Juggernaut, we did some Essential Logic songs, some songs which I'd written, and then we also played some songs that she'd written. But she sang on my songs and I sang on her songs. So it was a really nice collaboration.
Fun. Yeah.
And that's when Prayer for Peace came together as a song.
Wow.
And I also wanted to do a take of it on the Land of Kali because I felt like, you know, it was such a nice memory to share with her that in that song.
interesting how many new things you have to learn to catch up, like to pick up where you left off. Just the landscape artistically has changed so much in even just in 20 years. Everything's so much differently now.
Yeah. Had it been a while since you picked up the saxophone? Or do you practice a lot?
No. I mean, in 2019, I didn't even have a saxophone. I'd sold my last tenor for an air ticket to India about 12 years before.
Oh,
wow.
I didn't even have a saxophone, but it was such synchronicity because my mom, in her later years, took up the saxophone and she had one.
Oh, wow.
And then she got too old to play it, and she just gave it to me one day. So everything sort of happens just when it needed to. Everything, mm-hmm. the computer came in the house, saxophone came in. My daughter didn't need any lifts or cooking for anymore. And I could just throw myself back into Neurologic.
Wow. You talk about keeping them very separate, you know, like your family and your music career. Was your family, like, are your daughters, was she very aware of your musical history or?
Not really.
Yeah.
Okay. Not really. I remember we were on one holiday somewhere, and I played, she was 5 years old, and I played her Albert, the song Albert from Beat Rhythm News. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't believe it. She said, "Mom, is that you singing?" And she just started to laugh and laugh and laugh. And she peed herself. And there was a puddle on the floor. And she became uncontrollable. It was so outrageous, and she couldn't believe it was me. And but after that, I thought I better not play her anything else. So she didn't actually know. She wasn't really aware of. I mean, I used to tell her bits and bobs, but she didn't really take it seriously or believe me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe it myself when I got onto social media. I was the first post that I did. I had these messages from people saying, "Oh, we're so glad you're back, Nora." And people that were still listening to Pedigree Charm and Beat Rhythm News. And I was shocked then, and I'm still shocked now.
Yeah. It certainly lasted the, you know, time. I mean, it's still today. Like, it's been so great diving back into your music and just, hearing it, just so much of it at once. It's just been wonderful.
Yeah. Pedigree Charm. That record just blows me away. It's so, like, otherworldly compared to anything from that era. I mean, I'm wondering if things were rubbing off on you from maybe the rough trade community, or what was informing that sound?
Well, that was very... I mean, I was so inspired at that time by... recording that album with Philip Legg, who for me was just like the ultimate guitarist. You know, his minimal Fender Strat sound, and Charlie Hayward, you know, the drummer on that album, Charlie Hayward, who played with This Heat.
Yeah, he's incredible.
And he's still drumming. He's a legend, Charlie Hayward. And I'd never met him. I'd never heard his drumming before. But, and we just set up in this sort of dark, there was no windows, in an old meat fridge. It had been used to store meat. It was underground. There was no windows, and it was dark, but it was a rehearsal space owned by This Heat. And they were very cool. They just let us record the album there. We were there for months. But I was so inspired by particularly Charlie Hayward's drumming, everything about his energy. just so experimental, and anything was possible when you were playing with Charlie. And I think I got into that mood. The parts weren't really rehearsed particularly. They were very spontaneous. I just maybe had a few riffs, okay, like on Brute Fury. I had that initial intro riff, but then
iconic, by the way.
Yeah, but I couldn't believe that how much people like that song.
Profile. Today we have Laura Logic from Essential Logic and X-Ray Specs on the show. I'm Markley Morrison.
And I'm Dylan.
And let's get back into the interview.
I'm putting together a band now. We're a four-piece, and that's one of the songs that we're including, Brute Fury. So I'm very excited about doing some live shows again. It's really been a long time. We've only really done two. I've done two shows with different versions of Essential Logic in like 45 years. So really looking forward to diving back into doing some live gigs too, hopefully in December. And I'd love to come to the States. Never made it over there.
Yeah. Have you visited?
So much we'd like to come. No. Well, actually, we had Rough Trade lined up a US tour in, must have been 1981, for Essential Logic. It was sort of at our peak. But then I just packed up shop. I closed down the shop and I moved into a Krishna temple, because that's just what I needed to do then.
Yeah.
So never made it to the States, never made it, but I'm hoping. And we've been offered some gigs in Japan next year. Never been to Japan.
Oh,
either.
Yeah.
Absolutely do that. I've had the chance to play in Japan before, and people just really appreciate good art there. I wanted to know, with Pedigree Charm, it closes out with the song Rat Alley. I feel like that, even just on the album, is a departure from the rest of the record. Stylistically,
yeah.
And the way the acoustic guitar holds it all together, and the lilting vocals. I'm not sure what you're talking about, but it's affecting me emotionally. Every time I hear it, I feel like I'm about to cry, and I'm not sure what that is.
That was the second song. Yeah, I know. I'm very emotional about that song, too. It was actually after Aerosol Burns. It was the second song that I ever attempted to write, and I wrote it on an old acoustic guitar I found. It's the only time I've ever attempted to write a song on guitar, I would love to have taken up the guitar. But I just made up these chords. I had no idea what they were, if they had names or what they were. And I made up these chords, and that became Rat Alley, and the words came quite quickly. It was about, it was about Andy. Andy, and I always say his name wrong, Andy Jaworski. You don't pronounce it Jaworski, but he was the founder of the Roxy Club, you know, in Covent Garden. And it was a song about the Roxy Club, but not at all a funky song, just about some reflections whatever happened to the dirt and the perverse shirts, the unwashed loose where we would gather from the heat and the poses. Poses, poses, where are they gone to? Where's the beat and the high class speed? This is just about the Roxy Club.
Been about 20 years in between Essential Logic releases, give or take, with the compilation 20 years ago from Kill Rock Stars, now new music, and the box set that wraps up everything. So are we gonna need to wait another 20 for the next?
I do sincerely hope not. I'm really, to be honest, I'm no spring chicken, and I'm feeling time ticking by, and I'm trying to cram in as much as possible because I enjoy it so much. I love making music. I like recording. I like collaborating. Actually, there's going to be a surprise release, hopefully before Christmas, which I'm so excited about, so looking forward to. An album release.
As for the box set, were you very hands-on with that coming together and what it included?
Well, it's like I was saying, I recorded Land of Kali, and then I was just me alone in lockdown recording this album and trying to fathom my way through so many tunnels. But things just landed when they need to. And you know, step by step, things unfolded. And when I finished recording the album, Celeste Bell, she gave me some good advice, just to play it really to a few companies, and she said, oh, you could set up your own record company, Hiss and Shake. But then that was another, I ended up calling it Hiss and Shake, but that was another minefield, and I just, too many options. And then one day she said, oh, I've got a good friend, Kurt Pagan Davies, and I think he might just be the contact for you. So I went to have lunch with Kurt and Celeste in the London Temple restaurant, and Kurt was just like a wizard. He just came up with this idea of separating everything that had been released on the Fanfare in the Garden compilation CD, which basically had everything on it, and separating it into different vinyl albums, releasing it as a box set along with a new album, Land of Kali. And he had some great ideas, and we started working together in connection with Cargo Records. I officially registered Hiss and Shake as my own record company. And that's what we did. Meanwhile, I made some videos with Kathy. And that's the story so far. Been keeping me really busy. And then I formed a band last year for the release, the launch release of Land of Kali. We did one gig in London at Om Nom. Then I went to India at the beginning of this year for a recharge, because I hadn't left the country for about 3-4 years through lockdown.
Right.
Didn't want to travel during that time. So for a recharge, I went to India a couple of months beginning of this year, came back, and then put together another band, this four-piece that I mentioned.
I was wondering always, because you're the sax player, and in Essential Logic, the sax and the lead vocals are happening at the same time. So I assume that you played, you tracked this, your own sax parts, sang on top of them, but then for live, you had another saxophone player joining you?
Yeah. In the old days, in the in late 70s, the first incarnation of Essential Logic, we were a six-piece, and there were two saxophonists, the other one being Dave Wright, who was brilliant. I mean, he was technically far more accomplished than I am. And I had great fun duetting with him live. Yeah, and on Beat Rhythm News as well, he played on that. It's very difficult live, though. It was so hard. I really overstretched myself. Live, I'd sing a sentence, and then within a nanosecond, I was playing a sax riff. And by the end of the first UK tour, I think we were on the road for, I think it was about 4 weeks. I had bronchitis, and my lungs were totally done in. I was very ill thought out arrangements, because I just, it was too much. I was using my lungs too much.
Yeah, that's a lot of lung work.
Yeah. So now with a live set, I have to think very carefully about vocals. And Marlene, she's singing with us at the moment, so she sings a lot of the vocals as well. We split them, and I'm concentrating quite a lot on playing sax in the live show. And then we have a bass player who also sings. So we have three girls in the band at the moment, which is lovely. And one multitasking wizard, Danny Nellis. So I hope that this particular edition of Essential Logic can stay together, because it works really well.
Cool.
A little different to the first time around.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, as it should be. I feel like it's fair to say you're a different person now.
Yeah, in some ways the same, but yeah, I'm more comfortable now with who I am, who I've grown into. I'm a lot more comfortable. Yeah. Although I wish I had the energy of a teenager.
We don't want to take up too much more of your time here. I was wondering if you might have a vegetarian simple recipe that's a favorite in your kitchen that you might like to share, that we can try at home.
Well, I've never been asked that question before.
Well, try to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, I love you. I have to say, I'm really appreciating your questions. They're stretching me. Yeah, well, I don't know if it's the most exciting recipe, but something that's really simple that I can make most days is really just a one-pot dish. And it's an ancient Indian dish called khichdi. I've also been gluten-free for the last few years, but you can use rice and dal, the split mung beans. The yellow ones are best for health. They're best for all constitutions, very easy to digest. So you can just do half and half, like one cup rice and one cup split mung dal. And then I'll cook that for about half an hour. And then I'll normally add the vegetables towards the end of cooking so they don't overcook. Just throw them in the same pot. And then at the very end, I'll make what's called a chaunce, which is some ghee or butter. I like to use ghee because it's so good for the body. It's clarified butter.
Yes.
It's so good for health. So you just can melt some ghee in another pan and then add spices. The five most popular spices for health are cumin seeds, ginger, fresh if possible, little grated ginger, 1 teaspoon cumin seeds, maybe a teaspoon of turmeric. You can vary the spices according to your taste, but this is what I use. Mm-hmm. Cumin, ginger, pepper, because you need pepper to get the properties of the turmeric. You need the pepper to balance it. Mm-hmm. And then you can use some aspartame, tahini, or you could use some coriander, some ground coriander, or a bit of garam masala, whatever you like. And then you just add that to the cooked rice, dal, and vegetables. And that's it. It's nice with a bit of yogurt as well. Mm-hmm. That's good. And instead of rice, sometimes I'll use millet because I don't eat wheat. I find that millet is very satisfying. It's a bit heavier than rice. So especially in winter, I'll cook with millet instead of rice. And a bit of lemon as well. You need a bit of lemon juice to bring out the iron in the dal.
This is what I'm here for. You're making my mouth water.
Yeah, I'm hungry now.
Okay, maybe I should just stick to writing a recipe book. Maybe I'd earn more money that way.
I also have one very unexpected question from a fan online submitted. What is your favorite insect?
Now I'm going to have fun. What is my favorite insect? I guess the mind would gravitate towards bees, because bees are, you know, they're just so wonderful and they're so useful and amazing.
And they're cute.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so nice to see them in summer, in the flowers, and they're so busy, you know?
Notoriously
so. They're
so
busy.
Yeah. Well, Laura, thank you so much for enlightening us. It's been really, really great to learn from you today.
Yeah.
And get to know you a little better.
Okay, you too. You take good care of yourselves. And hopefully we'll connect again in the future.
This has been Low Profile. I'm Mark Lee Morrison.
I'm Dylan Shearer.
Next time we're going to be talking to Mayo Thompson from the Red Crayola. Thanks for doing this show again, Dylan.
Yeah, anytime.
Okay, we'll see you soon.
Low Profile receives in-kind support thanks to these independent Olympia businesses: San Francisco Street Bakery, Schwartz's Deli, Rainy Day Records, Old School Pizzeria, and Schirler Easy Premium Shitty American Lager from Three Magnets Brewing Company. And most of all, thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in.